pathway to healing can look a little bit different since we don't have a lot of information on it. And so I would say that you have to be a little more open to treatments that may not have a lot of scientific research backing them, or they have very, very small studies, because that may be something that changes your life in the long run. And that was the case for me. Everything I tried had such little science behind it, but it really made such a difference.
Alicia Wolf is a full-time chef who found her niche in preparing migraine-friendly meals after being diagnosed with chronic vestibular migraine. Her journey from diagnosis to treatment was filled with many twists and turns and inspired her to become a patient advocate for people with migraine. Alicia's own experience following a migraine diet greatly relieved her symptoms and allowed her to shift from a bedridden life to an active one. Alicia shares her knowledge and experiences in her cookbook, The Dizzy Cook, which features migraine-friendly recipes and treatment tips. Alicia, welcome to the Migraine World Summit.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yes, these are two topics that I know many of our watchers are interested in. So I think the first thing we need to cover is what exactly is vestibular migraine?
Yeah, so vestibular migraine is a type of migraine that can actually occur with or without head pain, which makes it a little bit harder to diagnose, and why it took so long for me to get an accurate diagnosis as well. It does come with light sensitivity or sound sensitivity, and most often patients experience feelings of dizziness, vertigo, dissociation symptoms. They feel like they're floating or moving when they're not. It can cause crazy, crazy symptoms in your brain that just make you feel like you're not in this world, you're not living in this world, you're just detached from everything, or that you're feeling movement that's not there. I mean, it's just a crazy sensation.
You mentioned the word dissociating, and that sounds like it can be a very scary thing to experience, especially if you're not having head pain. So you might not know it's a migraine. Is that the experience you had?
Yeah, so actually, that's what took me so long to get diagnosed with vestibular migraine, because I was experiencing these feelings, but doctors didn't quite understand what it was. A lot of them said I was stressed or dealing with depression, that I needed to, change my workload at work, just stuff like that. And no one could quite give me a straight answer as to why I was feeling this way, even after a lot of vestibular testing. And so it was scary to me to have these vertigo episodes and go to the ER and be diagnosed with vertigo, but have no explanation for it. So you can feel like you're going insane, but no one's validating it with a diagnosis.
That sounds extremely difficult. And like you said, because this is a migraine condition, but it doesn't present like a migraine, you weren't even going to the doctors yet with the knowledge to diagnose you. Is that correct?
Yes, so I actually saw about seven physicians, from ENTs to vestibular therapists to some of the top neurologists in Dallas, and everyone had a different opinion on it. But my vestibular tests were coming back negative and normal. My MRI was normal. And so everyone was like, well, you're presenting normal, so this must literally all be in your head. And I'm like, yes, well, it's my head, in my head. And I have anxiety and I have stress because I'm feeling this way, not because that's the cause of it, And so it was really about finding a doctor that believed in me and could look a little bit deeper, was how I ended up getting my diagnosis. And I actually drove 18 hours to go to the Mayo Clinic in Arizona, because some of the vestibular therapists I saw had said I could potentially have a paralymph fistula and I would need surgery that would leave me deaf for the rest of my life. So I was like, well, if I'm going to, pursue this, I really want to see an expert to get a second opinion. So I booked an appointment with an ENT there who was an expert in perilymph fistula. And after all my tests, he came into the room and he said, "You have migraine." And I said, "What? No, I don't get headaches." And to me, as someone who had never experienced a traditional migraine attack, I always just assumed migraine equaled headaches, like, you know, a lot of the world does. And I didn't realize that it could come with all these other symptoms. And he said, "Yeah, there's this specific type of migraine that's only kind of been recognized the last few years. And we're getting more information on it, but it can present in way, you know, you have the light sensitivity, the sound sensitivity, but you don't always need to have head pain with it. And you can have these feelings of vertigo and dizziness, and they come on like these attacks." And as my symptoms progressed and I wasn't getting a diagnosis, I can see clearly now that I was going from episodic to chronic. But back then, I had no idea. It just seemed like everything was getting worse. So it's interesting now to look back on my treatment, knowing so much more, and how maybe I could have stopped things from getting chronic if I had just seen a doctor who would understand what vestibular migraine was. Did get really lucky. He said, "You know, I'm an ENT. This is not my specialty. You see a neurologist or a neurotologist who understands vestibular migraine." And I really lucked out that my current neurologist, Dr. Shinbei, who I know you guys have had on here before, he is known as the dizzy doctor. And he was recommended to me as this doctor who could answer all these unexplained dizziness cases. And so I had been on his wait list for a really long time, for months. And just so it just so happened that when I finished at the Mayo Clinic, I got a call that he had a cancellation, could fit me in. And he was the one who confirmed my diagnosis, got me on the right track with treatment, and the rest is history.
And changed your life. I think it's really important. Your story really illustrates a problem so many patients have, is that we have to go through so many doctors often to find a diagnosis or to feel heard or to fully understand. And you serve as a great example to not give up. It might not be the fifth doctor, but it might be the sixth or the seventh. You just have to keep trying. Is that what you recommend to people
exactly.
that you speak to?
Yeah, I mean, it can be so frustrating, especially as a woman. I felt like a lot of doctors just spoke to my husband in appointments, which did help kind of get somewhere, bringing him with me to appointments. But there were times that they would just speak strictly to him and not even to me about my own symptoms. And it was frankly humiliating as a patient. And I just wanted someone to listen to me and not tell me that I was just anxious or depressed, because it's so easy to feel this way when you're experiencing these symptoms and no one's taking you seriously. So I think that, you know, we have so few headache specialists in this world. We need more. And then to have people or neurologists or ENTs who specialize in vestibular migraine, it's even fewer. So we're really limited in our resources. I think something that's come up that's been really, really helpful is teleconference. So some of these doctors you can actually see without having to travel or drive 18 hours like we did. And they can usually diagnose you just based off your symptoms.
That is a very exciting new development in healthcare, especially in the United States. I know that has become more regular now since the pandemic. Every year here at the Migraine World Summit, we receive lots of questions from people looking for treatment options who suffer from vestibular migraine. You found that a migraine diet was a very effective management tool. What does your personal migraine diet look like?
Yeah, so it's actually changed over the years. And I just want to be clear that it wasn't only a migraine diet that helped me get to these 100% disease-free days, but it was that final missing piece that really helped end the daily dizziness for me. And so that's why I'm such a huge advocate for it, because, you know, while it doesn't work for everyone, like any treatment, it can be very effective for some people. And in my case, it was.
So you found that when you started treatments, when you were finally diagnosed properly, they took you from maybe 100% amount of pain down to 25, and then this helped you get over the edge.
So the treatment plan that my neurologist originally put me on, which was a combination of medication and supplements, as well as watching my sleep schedule and also removing myself from my very stressful job, we got to about 60% better with that. And so I wasn't having as debilitating symptoms. I didn't feel like I was constantly walking on clouds or marshmallows, or that my head was always in a blender. But I did have dizziness every day, brain fog. I was still having some vertigo episodes. And so that's kind of when I looked into possibly adding in a migraine diet. And it was the migraine diet that actually took me from 60% to 100% days. And it did take some time, but it was really, really nice to start experiencing those dizzy-free moments throughout the day, and then finally getting to dizzy-free days. And so I think the combination of time mixed with the other therapies and then adding in that final piece was what took me to migraine remission, which was amazing.
That is really truly astounding. It's so interesting that food can be the missing link for some people like yourself. What is the basic theory behind a migraine-friendly diet?
So there are actually so many different migraine diets out there that I think that everyone, it seems like everyone has their own version of a migraine diet. What I chose to follow was, it's called the Johns Hopkins migraine diet. So they use it in the clinic, as well as it's made popular by a book by Dr. David Buchholz called Heal Your Headache. So some people may know it by both. It's been on a few websites, like AHS has their own version of it too. But basically, the idea behind a migraine diet is that you t remove common trigger foods, common migraine trigger foods from your diet for a limited time and give your brain a chance to sort of calm down. And in that sense, you increase your migraine threshold by doing your other treatments as well. So as your brain sort of calms down, you stop having so many attacks, you start feeling more like yourself every day. Then you slowly work to reintroduce some of these foods to see, do I even have migraine triggers, and what could they possibly be?
So, how long did it take from when you started this migraine diet until you started to feel relief? Was it days, weeks, months?
It was actually months for me. So I would say between about 4 months in, I started to experience dizzy-free moments throughout the day. And it was about 6 to 8 months in that I actually had dizzy-free days, and I felt comfortable to start bringing back in foods that I had eliminated. I remember about 2 months in, I was working really hard at it, and I wasn't really seeing any progress. And I thought, oh, this diet is garbage. Like, I'm just gonna stop. And I used to love tzatziki sauce with my lamb. And so anytime we ate like grilled lamb or lamb chops or anything like that. And so I remember one night I had prepared it, and I used yogurt as the base for it. And I think within an hour or so, I started experiencing a vertigo attack, and I hadn't had one in a few months. And the whole table really started moving on me. And I thought, oh my gosh, there's something here that's just not sitting right with me. Maybe there is a point to this, and I'm just going to continue with it. And it turns out, as I started reintroducing foods later, yogurt is still actually one of my big trigger foods.
It's so interesting that your journey with the diet kind of parallels your journey to a diagnosis, and
Yeah.
that it wasn't quick and it wasn't
No.
easy. And you just have to sometimes do these things for longer than is fair,
Yes.
which, I think as patients, we often feel like we've suffered long enough and we go through so much that we don't want to have to make more sacrifices.
Exactly.
Sometimes you just have to keep doing them to see the benefits. And you're proof of that.
You know, I think it took me maybe a little bit longer. I get messages from some patients who feel better after 2 weeks or a month, and they're already back to reintroducing foods. I would say most people tend to see some kind of results within 3 to 4 months. I know some patients who have taken a full year, which I don't know if I could have hung in there for a full year, but more power to them if they want to continue with that. And you know, they're feeling a lot better now and they're really happy they stuck with it. So yeah, I think with any migraine treatment, you know, even some of these medications, they can take 3 to 6 months to see results. On supplements are the same way. And it's hard to expect that any one thing is going to be that miracle treatment because it can take so long and it does take some consistency as well.
Yeah, it's great that you're being so honest about that because I think people tuning into this interview either know someone suffering from vestibular migraine or are suffering themselves. And we all want to hear that it's an easy fix, but unfortunately, it's not always easy.
Yeah. And, you know, everyone is just so unique too. I have some friends who got better just from trying supplements and diet changes. And I've had others that are still trying like meds. So it just seems to be completely individual based on your own migraine journey, which is also not something people usually like to hear.
No, unfortunately not. But that's the life that we're all living. That's the reality of it. So you found that yogurt was something that wasn't great for you. And you mentioned the Johns Hopkins headache diet. Is there a list of maybe 10 foods you can think of offhand that they recommend people avoid?
Yeah, so a lot of it are the common ones we hear all the time. So like aged meats and cheeses. We hear about caffeine, which does seem to be particularly hard on people with vestibular issues. Chocolate is the one that we hear all the time. Red wine is one that we hear all the time. But what was interesting about that is those didn't actually end up being my migraine triggers, my migraine food triggers. Like I can tolerate those pretty well. What did end up being some of my triggers were ones that you don't always hear about, but that are a part of this diet. So things like nuts, especially walnuts for me, tend to be a bad trigger, which was very shocking because I used to have almond milk in my coffee every morning. And now I'm starting to realize, oh, that was causing my dizziness every morning. But even like certain protein powders, collagen protein was one for me that I had to eliminate that made a huge difference. Things like citrus and onion, even and certain beans. So,
oh, no. How do you cook without onions? Oh, that's a tragedy.
There's actually a lot you can do. But that's usually everyone's first reaction. So it was my first reaction as well.
So as we're shifting to kind of reactions to this, the list you just mentioned is a little bit overwhelming. If you think, how do I eat without aged meat or cheese or lemon? I think I put lemon on everything I cook. What is your number one tip for people who want to try a migraine-friendly diet but feel completely overwhelmed by how different it is from the way they're currently eating?
Right. So first, I would say that's totally normal to feel overwhelmed. I was overwhelmed as someone who loves to cook and loves food. So give yourself a little bit of grace. I think the first month is really an adjustment period. And you know, one of the things that I missed from our list before is MSG, and particularly hidden MSG. I do see it to be a pretty common problem with readers in varying amounts, whether it's natural glutamate or, you know, actual MSG. And so what The first month of the migraine diet is really for is to kind of get you adjusted to making substitutions to some of your recipes, cooking more at home, reading labels. And those are things that we don't always do, especially when we don't feel well. We just kind of want to grab, frozen meals or pick up something easy from our local restaurant. And you can do that sort of thing. You just have to be a little more mindful of it.
Do you think that for the first month of a diet change, people need to follow any rules very strictly? Or can they ease into a transition, like saying, this week I'm going to eliminate food A, next week I'll eliminate this one and work their way up to it? Or do you think it's better to just go cold turkey?
It really depends on the person. So if you're one of those people who is all in on things, feel free to go all in. If it gives you more a sense of security to do things one at a time, I think that's totally okay. It's just starting, it's like starting any other medication or supplement. If you do it randomly, you might get more random results. Whereas if you do things consistently, you're probably going to see consistent, faster results. So if there's no rules on this, you can work it into your life however you want, but to see the most, the quickest results or the most life-changing results, you may need to take it a little bit more seriously. But there's always ways to do that while incorporating it into your lifestyle. And a lot of times, if you find yourself getting too wrapped up in everything and too focused on maybe labeling foods as good and bad, I highly recommend working with a dietitian because it shouldn't be that way. A migraine diet should be more about embracing the foods you can have, learning to cook with new spices that you may not have used before, and really just changing your mindset to embrace, okay, I'm going to focus on my health right now and eat these things that are great for my brain health.
I love that you reframe it that way because that was actually
Yeah.
my very next question. Instead of thinking about the foods we might need to eliminate, what are some foods that you can supplement into your diet that may provide relief?
Yeah, so actually, I just finished a book with my neurologist, and we really focused on foods that were great for brain health. So some of these things are like dark berries are really, really good to incorporate. Fish, especially for the omega-3s, I think we hear that all the time. Salmon is one that we hear a lot, but there are actually a lot of, no one ever says, okay, well, how do you incorporate your salmon easily into your diet? And a lot of that's where I can help is make salmon delicious. You don't just have to have plain salmon on a bowl of rice. You can do like a spicy salmon bowl, that's mixed with microwavable brown rice. And what I like to do is toss a little bit of a salad or like pre-made coleslaw with a little bit of toasted sesame oil and vinegar and use that as a base as well.
So you're really mixing some convenience food items with things that you have to take more time cooking. So the salmon you might cook yourself and prepare, but you can rely on things like 5-minute rice.
Exactly. Like I always keep frozen rice in my fridge, especially frozen brown rice or some quinoa in there that I can just microwave really, really easy in like 3 minutes, toss together some greens or, put them in the oven for a little bit. And then actually salmon turns out perfectly if you put it in the air fryer for about 9 to 10 minutes, perfectly cooked every single time. You can season it, with a little bit of toasted sesame oil, coconut aminos, make like a quick teriyaki sauce to it, or even just sometimes sweet chili sauce is really great on it, hot honey. There are lots of things that you could do with it, a little bit of oregano and basil. You can switch it up, and it makes a whole bowl. I like to, for the Asian inspired, I like to do a little spicy mayo mix with it and just put that on top of everything. And you have dinner in about 15 minutes with really, really minimal effort, but it still has a lot of flavor. You're not just eating plain salmon.
I love that. I love that you can use an air fryer because I know so many people are obsessed with them. I want to point out one ingredient you mentioned, which is coconut aminos. That's a substitute for soy sauce, correct? Is soy something that people might want to start avoiding?
So soy is a part of the general elimination diets, and it's not something I see as a very common trigger with patients who email me, but it's definitely worth just trying to eliminate it first and bringing that back in later on to see if it's a trigger for you. I think that also can be affected by higher glutamate content as well for people who are sensitive to that.
So anyone out there who really loves Asian foods and suffers a lot, maybe this is something they should look into.
Yeah, it's a good alternative. I'm all about alternatives.
We don't want to give up life, and we don't want to give up foods that we love and that make us feel at home. Food is such an emotional thing, and that's why it's so hard sometimes to alter our diets because we want to eat with our families and we want to eat with our friends. So yeah, it can be a very difficult transition emotionally as well as physically.
Yeah, and I think that, that's up to every patient to decide if the migraine diet is stressing you out and you're not enjoying it and you're miserable, then it's probably not the right treatment for you. There are lots of other ways you can get around it. It's just an option for people who are looking for something a little bit different, who maybe enjoy cooking or who are wanting to learn how to cook. And it was something that actually saved me because when I lost my job to migraine, I didn't really know who I was at that point. And what really made me feel more like myself was preparing a dinner and my husband and I sitting down together at the end of the day and just really enjoying this food. It was such a comfort to me, and it just made me feel like a normal person when the rest of my day I didn't feel like a normal person. So I think food has that ability to bring us together, to bring us comfort, to make us feel better. But as people with migraine, we're like, oh, how do we cook all of this? It just seems exhausting. But there are different levels to it, and there are lots of ways to have substitutions for the things you miss. And so it's not necessarily about restriction, but just a new mindset, really.
I know your website has some really helpful tips. It has lists of safe foods, lists of foods you may want to eliminate, all spelled out for you. So if people feel overwhelmed, you can go to her website and there's a pantry list. I mean, it'll tell you the exact brands so you don't have to spend so much time in the store reading the labels. Alicia has read the labels for you.
For you.
So that's really great because if you are suffering from brain fog and vertigo and head pain and exhaustion, it can feel overwhelming to pick up a mustard label and see if you can eat this mustard or not. It can just
I
seem like
know.
a mountain. So I love that your site breaks it down and makes it getting started a little bit easier.
Yes, it was everything I wish I would have had when I first started and I was super symptomatic. I just wanted to put it all in one place for people. And even on my Instagram, I do like grocery hauls at Trader Joe's or for Costco or different grocery stores. So you can check those out too and get some ideas there on maybe things that interest you.
For people looking to shift into a different way of eating to help with their migraines, we've spoken how it can be so intimidating. What does a migraine-friendly breakfast, lunch, and dinner maybe look like?
Yeah, so I'll just kind of take you through a few things that I like to do. So a few of my favorite breakfasts just look like a combination of eggs, sometimes hash browns mixed in there, toast with sun butter on it. And I like to do fresh berries or even a smoothie. I have an anti-inflammatory smoothie recipe on my website that's very, very popular, especially with people on attack days. Maybe when you have a lot of nausea, it seems to be pretty effective for that. overnight oats, cottage cheese with berries. These are all things that are make a wonderful quick breakfast as well. For lunch, I'll typically like to meal prep this. So I will either do a what I like to call a naked rotisserie chicken. So it's not scandalous chicken, but it's just a chicken baked in olive oil, maybe with salt and pepper. Sometimes you can find this at like Whole Foods or Sprouts or your local grocery store. Sometimes it's pretty easy to make at home, actually. And I'll just pick that off and use it for sandwiches the rest of the week. You can put it in soups. There's lots of vegetarian soups that you could do as well with garbanzo beans, which is really, really hearty and filling as well. A lot of these can be made in the crock pot ahead of time as meatballs in a sandwich. So it can be really, really easy to meal prep this ahead. And then my dinners usually look like a combination of something frozen. So either, brown rice from the fridge that I just microwaved, quinoa, some kind of whole grain. And then I like to mix that with a few greens. So whether that's roasted broccoli or doing a bed of greens somehow in a bowl, mixed with a little bit of vinegar and some kind of olive oil or toasted sesame oil. And then I usually like to put some kind of protein on it. So that would be, salmon in an air fryer with different types of spices, maybe a little sumac for something tart. The meatballs you could use again as well, or even just a simple pasta with chicken on top of it would be really, really wonderful. I have a super popular recipe for Boursin pasta, which is my take on fettuccine Alfredo. So instead of using the aged cheese, it uses a fresh cheese instead, but it still kind of hits that creamy hearty dish for those occasional days where you need that comfort food.
Thank you so much for sharing this list because a lot of these foods sound like foods we may already be eating with just a slight alteration. That doesn't seem that intimidating.
Exactly. I mean, even tacos and enchiladas, those are my go-to. And whether you're a vegetarian or you're a meat eater, those can be really customized to whatever you like to eat. And you can also put lots of vegetables and fresh herbs on top of them. And I even have, because yogurt and sour cream tend to be an issue for me, my secret way to top them is with whipped cottage cheese. So it's like a mixture, it's like a substitute for sour cream, but it tastes kind of cheesy and it's actually really wonderful. So, if people ever need these substitutes, just message me. I'm happy to help because my brain just thinks this way now.
And they can find your information on how to message you on your website. Can you give us that name of that website again?
Yes, it's thedizzycook.com, and all of my social media is just at thedizzycook. So you can find me on there as well as on my website, and just shoot me an email, however, whatever works for you.
I want to talk a little bit about supplements. You mentioned that in addition to changing your eating habits, you also added supplements and you found relief from them. Do you know of any science about the supplements that you're taking, why they may be effective?
Yeah, I think that what is usually most recommended for people with migraine are magnesium, especially B2 is a very common one, and CoQ10. A lot of these have studies to back it up and how they can affect migraine or lessen migraine days. And so these are something that I recommend working with your neurologist on, especially for amounts. But I did find that certain ones were more beneficial than others. So currently, I take three types of magnesium. When I started feeling sick, I took B2, but now I realize I no longer really need it. And so that was in a supplement I ended up stopping later on in my journey. And then I've taken CoQ10 and ubiquinol off and on for different things, but I've always consistently worked with my physician to decide what was best for me when.
And it's great to know that some of these supplements don't have to be for life, that maybe you
Yeah.
just need them for a time to help calm down your brain, get things more regulated, and then you can adjust from there. Because supplements can be expensive, and it's hard to kind of think like, am I going to be spending this forever?
Yeah, there's no reason to spend a lot of money on something because it works for someone online, you know?
Internet said it has to be true.
It may help. And, you know, it's a good point that you need to give things a few months because I do get a lot of emails like, oh, this didn't work for me within a week or two. And I'm like, well, you know, you should probably give it a little bit longer time to really see if it kicks in. But magnesium is one that's been super helpful for me in a multitude of ways. And that's when I actually take three different types, but there's a certain type, magnesium 3 and 8. It really helps me with my brain fog. So because caffeine is a big trigger for me and I had to eliminate it, I can't even do regular decaf. I have to do a special kind called Swiss water processed decaf. And then I don't feel anything. But because of that, I miss out on that caffeine. I'll do the magnesium 3 and 8 in the morning, which kind of helps wake my brain up. And I like magnesium glycinate at night to kind of calm everything down. And magnesium citrate has been really helpful for me during pregnancy. So it's a good idea to look into your supplements, why you would be taking them, what does your lifestyle require, and how does this fit into your lifestyle as well. But don't just take it because someone online said it.
Shifting gears, in your experience, what is the biggest hurdle of receiving a vestibular migraine diagnosis?
I would say, and this is 6 years ago, it's changed a lot now since I was diagnosed, but I would say finding doctors who understood vestibular migraine and even vestibular therapists. I mean, you would think vestibular therapists would understand it, but finding a doctor who really understood it and could treat it was probably my biggest hurdle. And if I would have just gone to a neurologist that was familiar with it right off the bat, it could have saved me a lot of trouble and potentially losing my job, and it would have maybe changed my life. So it's hard to go back because I am happy with where I am now, but I'm also grateful that nowadays it seems like people have a lot more resources available to them. You know, last 6 years ago, we really only had vestibular.org, and that was all the resources we had talking about vestibular migraine. And now it seems to be more common that we have more vestibular therapists talking about it, more doctors discussing it. You know, we've had some really amazing talks on Migraine World Summit about it. So I feel like it's starting to get talked about a little bit more, but I know there are still people out there being misdiagnosed. And then you have a lot of doctors who also don't understand fully how to treat it and how different it might be from traditional migraine.
What do you think people living with vestibular migraine have to do differently in terms of treatment or lifestyle?
Yeah, so I would say the most important is to find a doctor who specializes in vestibular disorders or vestibular migraine specifically. It may be an ENT, it could be a neurologist or a neurootologist, which has a little T in the middle there. And they tend to be experts on the vestibular system and how it can affect migraine as well. And so, usually calling around and asking, hey, are you familiar with this can help. I have a list of doctors who treat vestibular migraine specifically, and it's full of a range of them. So, I think that's what makes it kind of tricky is you have some ENTs treating it, some neurologists treating it, and they're also limited by their scope of education as well. So, sometimes they have to work with each other or bring in vestibular therapists. And it really is a multi-prong approach when it comes to vestibular migraine because occasionally vestibular therapy can also be a part of it too. So there are lots of people that you might need in your care. And to start off with a doctor who has those resources and can refer you to those resources, it will really change the outcome of your treatment.
So it sounds like the main difference is not only finding a specialist, but you might have to work with multiple people just because so many doctors' knowledge is hyper-focused on their own specialty. So you're really crossing specialties to get some treatment, a treatment plan.
Exactly. And a lot of people with vestibular migraine can have comorbidities. So Meniere's disease is one of them. VPPV is another, and these are different type of vestibular disorders, and they tend to be more common in people with migraine. TRPPD is one that we're seeing a lot more often too in this community. And so that can make this whole diagnosis a little more tricky than just vestibular migraine. And that's where having an expert who's seen these patients, who's treated these patients, and can kind of look outside the box a little bit, especially when it comes to treatments, is key. That's one thing that I really loved about my neurologist. And something that also is interesting to me when it comes to a migraine diet is, although the migraine diet doesn't even have a lot of scientific evidence for that, which is difficult when we have such variable food triggers, or some people don't even have food triggers. It's the same thing with treatments as well. And a lot of treatments weren't even studied for vestibular migraine back then. We're getting a few here and there, but everything that worked for me didn't have a lot of scientific research behind it. And so that's where I really had to rely on my doctor for anecdotal evidence. What was he seeing in his clinic? What was working for other patients? And I think that's what's so important to the vestibular migraine community is you do kind of have to read other people's stories online and gather what they're doing and what's working for them, because the pathway to healing can look a little bit different since we don't have a lot of information on it. And so I would say that you have to be a little more open to treatments that may not have a lot of scientific research backing them, or they have very, very small studies, because that may be something that changes your life in the long run. And that was the case for me. Everything I tried had such little science behind it, but it really made such a difference.
And sometimes having little science behind it doesn't mean that it is an unknown treatment or a treatment that hasn't been used. It just means that the funding and the research has not been done yet.
Exactly. Yeah. And especially when it comes to vestibular issues as well.
So before we leave today, I love to ask, since you are an advocate and a person with migraine, what advice do you have for people living with or taking care of someone who experiences vestibular migraine?
I think the most important thing that you can do is just believe them and support them, because it's really hard to not want to fix things or not be able to fix things, And that was something my husband struggled a lot with, is he wanted to just fix it. He thought if I just went to the right doctor, or if I just did the right thing, or I did the right pill, then I would get better. And that wasn't the case at all. I mean, it was really a journey of testing and trying what worked out for me. And so I would say, like, just being supportive of them and being like, I'm really sorry this didn't work out. Don't worry, we're going to find something that does. You have so many options to go. I'm going to be right here for you. In my community, I see so many moms and wives or husbands cooking for their significant other or their friend and dropping off food for them that's migraine friendly or that they know can get them through a really, really bad attack time. And that to me is just so healing, that act of giving and in giving to someone else who's in need. I think it can actually be very healing for us as people with migraine as well. And so I would encourage that if you have like a friend or a family member that you could maybe trade off with, or you could say, hey, I really need your help. I just can't make this food right now. Can you make this recipe for me and bring it over? I mean, that can mean the world to someone too. So I think just even if you can't quite understand what they're going through, just being supportive of them can make all the difference.
I love the idea of having people that you speak to that maybe you can speak to while you're not in an attack and say, hey, I have this problem and you've asked how you can help me. And here are ways you can help me when I'm in an attack, whether that's helping me leave where we are, making sure I'm in a quiet space, helping me get these foods. it really can make such a huge difference. So yeah, it's great to get that out there, maybe before you're suffering, so that people can help you actively when you are not at your
Exactly.
cognitive best. Is there anything your husband does specifically for you during an attack? Does he get the room ready? Does he have the lighting perfect? Is there something specific?
No, I would say that we're kind of a well-oiled machine at this point. I know how to kind of manage my own attacks, so he will drive me a lot if I need to get somewhere, and he also will order me IV therapy if that is something I need. So that's really, really nice of him. He just comes up with thoughtful things like that, like, oh, I'll make dinner tonight, or oh, I'll make sure this is ready. But for me, during an attack, I kind of know what works and I just go straight to it. And yeah, once you figure out what works for you, and you can kind of stabilize yourself, ground yourself, whether that be like sitting on the floor and deep breathing, those kind of things you just go to automatically, like it's ingrained in your head.
This has been such an informative and interesting talk, and I know people are going to want to learn more about everything we've discussed. Where can we learn more about the migraine diet and what you're doing or follow your work?
Yeah, so I have a website, thedizzycook.com. All the recipes and information on there is totally free to patients. I have a cookbook if you're interested in trying an elimination, but you want lots of good comfort foods to eat. It's called The Dizzy Cook, and you can find it almost everywhere books are sold. And then I actually have a cookbook out that's very new called The Mediterranean Migraine Diet, which I did in partnership with Dr. Shin Bae. So the traditional elimination diet that we kind of discussed is only meant to be done for a short amount of time and then you reintroduce foods. But this Mediterranean diet is more about long-term brain health and how to eat for long-term brain health, especially if you discover you have certain triggers through the elimination process. So it'll be kind of the next step for people if they want a long-term way of eating, or if they think elimination is not right for them. This book could be helpful for that.
Oh, that's so great. Are there any other resources that you like to re recommend? Any other websites that you found useful or books?
Yeah, so I would actually recommend my neurologist's book, Victory Over Vestibular Migraine. Heal Your Headache. Some of the information is should be updated, but overall, it's a really great book to help understand the migraine threshold theory and especially how everything works together and why the diet works for some patients. And then I would also recommend vestibular.org as a resource, especially if you're experiencing a lot of vestibular symptoms. They have support groups, and we have a conference every so often, and they really, really focus on patients with vestibular issues.
Alicia, it has been a pleasure talking to you today and learning more about vestibular migraine from being a patient to an advocate to a chef. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.